The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Lojong Teachings, the 7 points and 59 slogans for generating compassion and resilience. Point 2, train in empathy and compassion. Absolute compassion. So in this text that we're exploring with the help of Zen teacher Norman Fisher's book, Training in Compassion, we move now to point 2, which has 2 aspects to it and a number of slogans attached to it. Point 2 is about bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is translated here by Norman Fisher as compassion. And that is definitely one of the meanings of bodhicitta, which arises in 2 forms, as both absolute and relative. And as Zen practitioners, we can relate to the arising of phenomena in 2 forms, as absolute and relative, because we talk about this all the time. In our chant book, there are many references to emptiness and form, to the relative and the absolute. And many of our koans and studies that we do privately with our teachers also bear on these 2 ways of viewing reality, as from the absolute viewpoint and from the relative viewpoint. One of my favorite translations of absolute and relative is straight and crooked. There are so many ways of understanding this in language. Also, yang and yin. So what do these things mean, absolute and relative, and how can we put them into practice in our lives? This is the challenge of not only Lojong, but of all Zen practice and any practice that encounters the innate inner conflicts of being human. There is what we call the world of the relative. And most of us know the world of the relative very well because we began our training in understanding the relative, the world of form, when we were very, very young. As soon as we started to encounter self and other, and good and bad, and right and wrong, and not touching a hot stove, and not running out into traffic, and being careful when we stand up that we're balanced so we don't fall down. All of these things in the first few years of life become a way of life for human beings. We know that some things attract us and other things repel us. And this is true for all beings, really, because all beings are oriented towards survival. And survival means understanding the relative world. Sometimes we call this relative world the world of consensual reality. That is, we all agree on most of these things, not all of these things. We agree about right and wrong, good and bad, this and that, you and me especially, the separation of categories, everything falling into oppositional categories. The problem, of course, with this is that taken to an extreme, relativity and consensual reality, the world of form, can get us in a lot of trouble. The world right now is in a lot of trouble because of the focus on the relative, on separation, on the monks of the Eastern and Western Hall fighting about a cat, a story that many of you know from our koan tradition. So this world of the relative, which we have to learn how to live in order to survive and thrive as humans, once we realize that it's not enough because it keeps us trapped, imprisoned in this world of opposites, that's when the hunger for awakening arises. the hunger for some spiritual tradition that will help us to see through this terrible suffering that all of us carry around with us because of this feeling of separation, the feeling of division. And the word religion itself, the derivation from Latin, means to bind together again that which has been separated. The wholeness into which we're born, which rapidly dissolves when we don't get enough to eat or when our diapers are wet. All of this is something that we long for. And different forms of psychology and philosophy, different forms of religion, encounter this great problem of how to live in a world that is so divided with the sense, this deep, deep sense of wholeness at the base of everything that is barely in consciousness at first, and then rises as a kind of longing, a longing for connection. And this longing for connection can also take the form of longing for relationship, longing to be with a romantic partner, the loneliness that many of us feel on a regular basis, and those of us who are in relationships sometimes still feel that loneliness with our partners, because romantic love and even friendship and spiritual companionship, all of this isn't enough if we still feel separated at the deepest part of our being, separated from that wholeness that we sense is there, but which just keeps sneaking out of reach. So this is where the absolute comes in. The absolute is something that we begin to recognize in our Zen practice, sitting upright in the middle of everything. We begin to get a sense of the rising and falling of phenomena, the rising and falling of thoughts and emotions and physical sensations and sense perceptions. They don't last. We can't find their beginnings or their endings, and yet we know that we can rely on the changeable nature of them, the ephemeral nature of them, which is one reason why the very first slogan in the absolute compassion or absolute bodhicitta point is see everything as a dream. Because in this dream world that we are living in, which we think is reality, which we've all agreed to live in as reality, things have no lasting substance. We know this simply by observing the passing away and the rising of all phenomena. Just like in a dream, nothing lasts. So normally in teaching about this in Zen, and in actually most forms of Buddhism, including Tibetan Buddhism, first we encounter the world of form, and then we encounter the world of emptiness. We know the world of form so thoroughly, we only slightly sense the world of emptiness, this world of wholeness, thusness, shunyata, the oneness of all beings, the oneness of all phenomena. We only sense it, and then it begins to rise again and again and again until we can't ignore it, until it gets so strong that we see that emptiness, that thusness, that wholeness is co-arising with form, with the relative, all the time. And then we learn how to live a life of cultivating both of these things, and also recognizing that the cultivation can only happen because the seeds of both are always present. And so we nurture, and they grow. We nurture them through our meditation practice. In the Lojong practices, kind of strangely or oddly, the teachings are reversed, and the teachers and all the commentaries that I've been looking at around this topic say pretty much the same thing, that we have to cultivate the absolute first. We have to open to wholeness first, because if we go to the relative too fast, then we're just memorizing how to be good people. We're just memorizing how to be compassionate based on some kind of set of rules that we've gained from wherever, the precepts or the teachings or trying to be like our teachers or following the guidelines of famous teachers of the past. We are fake compassionate beings. We're just doing the motions. But to be rooted in the absolute and wholeness is to recognize that we live in an ocean of wholeness, of thusness, of what we call, what Norman Fisher calls compassion and what the original texts call bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is a word that literally means, bodhi means awake, like it's related to the word Buddha, which means the one who is awake. So bodhi means awake, and citta is a Sanskrit word for the heart mind. The 19th century scholars in English who translated Buddhist texts just called it the mind. But we know that it's really not just the thinking, discursive mind that generates thoughts, but something much bigger than that, the heart mind. So citta sometimes is just called the heart. And when we put them together, the awakened heart mind, there's an equal sign to compassion. Because once we recognize bodhicitta in ourselves and in our lives, we can't help but be compassionate. We can't help but see that we and everyone and everything, every being we encounter, is us. That when we have a nasty thought, it's not just private. It generates nastiness throughout the universe. When we have a loving thought, it's not just private. It generates loving kindness throughout the universe. This is not some kind of fantasy, new age thing. It's a deep, deep teaching about the interconnectedness of everything. Everything really is just one thing, but it differentiates into the relative, into form all the time. And so we're sometimes blinded by that relative divisiveness. So we have to learn to recognize the great ocean of awareness that we're living in. We have to recognize it and taste it and feel it and come to rely on it. And one of the things that I found really compelling in doing some of the research on absolute bodhicitta is the teachings on this matter from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, a Tibetan teacher who wrote one of the first books in English about the Lojong practices that's called Training the Mind. And he talks about the way to bodhicitta, and in fact, bodhicitta itself, compassion itself, as a wound. That every human being has some place of tenderness, some place in us that has been hurt, a place that we can barely touch because it's so sensitive. And this sensitivity, this woundedness, this painful place, he uses all kinds of very vivid language to describe it, a slice in the skin. Every one of us is vulnerable. There's been a lot of talk in modern psychology about the importance of vulnerability, of being, of allowing ourselves to not disguise our woundedness, not throw it in the dumpster, as we were talking about yesterday, but to value it. From our woundedness comes our strength, because that's the place where we can let our hearts be touched. If we recognize that everyone we encounter, and Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talks about even monstrous people, people who've done great evil, have this wound that they use in a way that harms others. But we can use our woundedness in a way that connects us to others. So to be able to do this, Trungpa says this, Norman Fisher says this, all of the commentators say pretty much the same thing. We have to learn to abide in wholeness and trust it and lean into it. And one of the sweetest things that the commentators say is that if we focus on relative bodhicitta, that is, relative compassion, and forget about this absolute quality of compassion, of bodhicitta, then when we are lost and afraid, when we are lost in our woundedness or tired or sick or dying, we forget that we don't have to do it all. And we can lean back into this absolute quality, which is always present, not always recognized, not always sensed or known, but always present. And when we get to a point where things have become so impossible that we can no longer do anything to help ourselves or others, and I personally have been in that place many times in my life, sometimes more than others. This last year has been a great teaching in the impossibility of doing anything to repair a broken situation. So painful, so difficult. And then finding that absolute bodhicitta was just waiting for me, holding me up like the salt water in the ocean holds us up when we float. If we just surrender to it, there's no possibility of going down into our lost place. And even the going down, maybe not such a problem. This is that woundedness, that vulnerability that Trungpa talks about. Just letting it all fall apart. That's the moment when absolute awareness arises, not because we've been really good little Zen students who have been working really hard and passing lots of koans and reading lots of books and really getting some kind of understanding about all this stuff. No, it's that time when everything falls apart, when everything falls away. One of the very first times that I had an experience of bodhicitta was just such a time in my life when everything appeared to have fallen away. It really hadn't. It wasn't such a big deal. But for me at that time, it felt awful, terrible, like my life was over. And then suddenly, as Dogen talks about, suddenly the things of the world came to my heart. Rather than me running around reaching for everything, trying to do the things that I thought I was supposed to do, in that surrendering, everything appeared. Everything shining with its own light. I didn't do it. I didn't even surrender. I just got lost in my wound, in my vulnerability. You can't strategize this. I want to warn you. You can't say, oh good, now I know what to do. I'm just going to focus on my woundedness. Later in the Lojong teachings, they warn us against that. Don't dwell on all this crap. That's not it either. Just moment after moment, being aware of what is arising. So absolute bodhicitta arises all by itself. Thusness, this world that we can live in. The tendency in Zen practice is once this happens, we cling to it, and then that clinging itself becomes the relative again, and we get lost in the relative. We can't have one without the other. They co-arise. It would be nice to be in a world of emptiness all the time, but sitting in emptiness is always doomed. Just having to go to the bathroom destroys it. You can't sit on the cushion forever in this absolute. The body won't let us. The body needs to be fed and rested, hydrated, and it needs to do its functions of elimination. Thank goodness. That keeps us grounded. That's our wonderful Taoist heritage about when we're hungry, we eat, and when we're tired, we sleep. Without that illuminated relativity, without the absolute relative combined like that. The yin and yang symbol demonstrates this from our Taoist ancestors, part of the circle being yin, the dark, but always with a spot of yang, the white, in it. And then the other part of the circle being white, the yang, with a little spot of dark, the yin, in it, constantly moving around in circles. Our Taoist ancestors arise in our koan tradition when we get towards the end of koan practice, although there's never any end, and we encounter the five ranks or the five modes. This is all connected to different combinations of relative and absolute, of yin and yang, of broken and solid. Over and over and over again, we lean back and forth into absolute and relative. And then at some point, there is a point when even the separation between relative and absolute drops away. And there's just this, fully whatever it is, part of the great absolute open whole being, and also just so particular. That's another translation of the world of form, the particular, and the world of the absolute, the general. We keep going back and forth and back and forth until they integrate with each other perfectly. And then they fall apart again, and then they integrate, and they fall apart and integrate. And that, too, is the action of bodhicitta. And the last thing I'll say about bodhicitta is that one of the translations of bodhicitta, not the literal translation, so we know that it means the awakened heart-mind, and we also know that it means compassion, because once the heart-mind is awakened, there is nothing else to do but be in connection with others fully. Empathy and sympathy combined. Just this one great chain of being. When other people suffer, we suffer with them. When other people rejoice, we rejoice with them, because their suffering is our suffering and their rejoicing is our rejoicing. So awakened heart, mind, and also compassion. And the third meaning of bodhicitta is a great energy for awakening. And this is related to that reliability, like the great ocean holding us up when we surrender. The great ocean of being, of awareness, of wakefulness, carrying us without us having to be in charge of it. There's an energy that arises when we're on retreat. There's an energy that arises when we take our seat for daily practice that is not ours, doesn't belong to us, and also is completely ours. This energy that is just driving us towards awakening. And this great energy, and we can feel it sometimes. It's like we're on a train, an express train, heading towards a place that we've never been and that we've lived in all our lives. The great energy of awakening fills us, beats our hearts, and makes our blood flow. Some people call it God. Some people call it Buddha. Some people call it the great nothing. Some people call it Mu. Some people call it the single hand. It doesn't matter what you call it. Bodhicitta is another name for it. But this great energy. So the awakened heart-mind in the absolute form and the relative form, and the awakened heart-mind that turns itself naturally towards compassion and which is energized by all things. This is what the second point about absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta, absolute compassion and relative compassion, are guiding us towards. Thank you. And please make yourselves comfortable. In a moment, we'll go around and say our names. And just a reminder that this talk is being recorded. So if you don't want anything you say recorded, just say, please stop the recording. My name is Melissa.
Camden.
I'm Jenny.
Ray.
Kaden.
Chris.
Bob.
Carolyn.
Fabian.
Allie.
Francesca.
David.
So this is a time, as I think you all know, for questions, observations, reflections about the talk or anything about what's going on with your practice.
When I was listening to you talk, I was thinking of the reading we did, the harmony of relative and absolute, and that bit about ordinary reality fits the absolute like a box and lid. And I don't know, I was just visualizing that.
Yeah.
And ordinary reality is so jagged and fractal and intricate, you know, and the box and the lid are so precision engineered. And yet you can fit something.
Yeah, yeah.
But not smooth it out and make it boring either.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. That's so important. It's one of the reasons that I picked that chant for today, because it says the same stuff, but from a Zen, using Zen language. I just love that, a box and its lid.
And I think so important that the last thing you said, that sometimes we can think that there is something that will smooth out life, right? And that's what I want, this special thing I can spread over my whole life. It's actually much more fun and interesting than that, that this particularness, this jaggedness, that sometimes is so troublesome, it's like so difficult. But this this contains the seed of love, of compassion in all of the particulars. How it fits together is not kind of a dulling of everything, but a vividness. And as Melissa said, everything shines with its own light. All of the jagged and the smooth edges. So quite wonderful.
I've been, from a pretty different perspective, reading this week the autobiography of Ellen Pagels, who translated the Gnostic.
Oh, Elaine Pagels, yeah.
Elaine?
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, she, in the midst of doing this work, has these terrible tragedies. Her six-year-old son dies of cancer, and then within a year, her husband dies. And she goes through a real spiritual crisis. She's been struggling with spirituality anyway, trying to figure out. But she feels like people keep saying things like, oh, you know, this will make you stronger. God never sends you more than you can handle. And she gets very angry at that and trying to find any meaning out of it. And so she eventually just kind of gives up and lets herself be in a terrible, horrible place. And it takes her to a place not really in intellectual understanding, but just a sort of experience of this is what it is to be a human being, me and everyone else. This, and it just sort of, the way she described it was very interesting, from her struggle with Christianity, but feeling really in the end, it's just being human.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It doesn't make me better, it just makes me part of everybody, part of this whole.
Well, and I think that, you know, both the struggle, which is so necessary for all of us, and then this giving up, this surrender, that as Melissa said, it is not something you can choose to do. Although we do, okay, I'm really going to surrender this period. I'm really, you know, I am set, I am giving up. It just creates another kind of holding on, so this surrender that happens, and sometimes it only happens when we get so tired and so discouraged, this woundedness that we fight and we fight, I have to hold myself together, I have to until we're just out of have to's. And in that, we are opened. We don't open ourselves. Okay, I'm going to open myself, but life opens us, and then we find what this connection. I love her talking about, oh, this is human. Yeah, no escape, no possibility of fixing or even understanding on some level, but appreciating, accepting. Yeah.
And it's really a callback to the preliminaries. You know, the right. Those of you who know those. This human life, it's so brief. You know, it's full of suffering. These are things that it's important to remember. And it's so lucky to be born human. That's the other side of it, right? That we get to wake up as human beings. All other beings are already awake, but we get to actually experience it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I think when I have a glimpse of being in the ocean of compassion, I begin to see that I've always been in the ocean of compassion. And I just didn't know it, or I fought it, or I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted freedom from my, release from my suffering, I wanted happiness, I wanted all this, and yet, here I am, it's all around me.
Exactly.
And it's manifesting
yeah.
as the very things that I am yeah. fighting.
Yeah. You know, struggling
with.
Yes.
It's not different. But I resist it, you know. To see, you know, to begin to realize that compassion has always been there. I've always been in the ocean of compassion, continuously offered to me. I grew up Catholic, so the concept of God always being present, always inviting me to greater intimacy. In how? Not in the way that I think it should be.
Yeah, right.
But through experiencing, you know, through my senses,
yeah.
this human experience. And in that, trusting that, you know, that's with the breath and being and the body and so mm-hmm. on, gradually creates that. And for me, at least, sort of like it puts me, I pay more attention to the call, mm-hmm. you know, the call of compassion, the call of something greater than myself, just, you know, wanting intimacy with me.
Yeah.
Calling my name.
Calling your name, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, the this idea, two ideas that you're touching into and talking about, one is that it's always been there and you've forgotten. And the other is that everything is it. So even the unwanted, maybe especially the unwanted, is it. You know, that's in the, when we're in the ocean of compassion, when we're floating in that space, that's just like, of course. But when we start going back into the world of the absolute, of the relative rather, it's like, wait a minute, no. That part couldn't be it. And you can feel the mind, you know, protesting almost. It wants its superiority. And this is, David mentioned this yesterday, I think it was David, yeah, about the original Pali word for mindfulness. It's been translated as mindfulness, sati. Really means remembering, recollecting. It doesn't mean to be mindful, like to pay attention. It means, oh, right. Oh, yeah, I'm holding a cup. Cup, I, what? Water. It's like, oh, this is it. You know, it's not like, let me be very careful here. Let me go very slow. It has this other quality of recognition.
Yeah.
The sort of edge of my practice that I best struggle with is just have the words.
It's a good demonstration of how the mind works.
Space station and the cord gets cut and then you're just gone. You're just gone, you know.
It's a
feeling like if people in your life have wronged you, it's a feeling, oh, if I surrender to this, then I can't trust anyone ever again.
Right.
Oh, if, you know, I accept this vulnerability, then the world is not safe.
Well,
it's always been true.
You say that quite well. You know,
it's a fear that it will mark your
right life. And this, we've really been taught to hold ourselves together, get your shit together. You know, and this root fear, if I do not keep selfing myself, if I do not keep defending, that it's the ultimate shame. What's wrong with you? You fell apart. Right? And I think it's so important to be with that fear. Like, it's not just about pushing through. Well, what the heck? But the vibration of that fear, like, sitting upright in the middle of that, because that too, is it. And that, again and again, for all of us, there are places we come where it's really clear that this is the wrong direction, right? The mind says, don't go there. And we have to be careful in those places, because these are very huge forces we're dealing with. These are human fears. So it's not about just going crazy and, you know, smashing through sometimes, but much more about, well, let me just try a little bit. And part of the container here on retreat is to make it safe enough where, okay, just for this next breath, what happens if I don't try quite so hard? Right? I'll do one breath. So it sometimes seems like it's incredibly dramatic and it's all or nothing, but we actually get to practice in these real subtle ways. Just, what if just these next two steps, I follow my feet? Right? Oh, okay. So far, so good. I'll try three. but so I really, so it's about being present where we are and trusting that even in this fear, this is the aliveness of life too.
Yeah, that's a really subtle teaching that's hard to... The thing is that you experience that, and, oh, this is the distancing from yourself, but that's it. That's the teaching.
So to be with the distancing, like, and this is how it is to be human. Right, and we think, well, this is what's wrong with me. Look, here it is again. Here I am distancing, and so we stop in the middle, wherever we are, and go, this is how human beings feel. This is what it means to be human, and we say, can I open my heart here? So I want to be compassionate. Can I be just a little kinder to myself here? This is how it is, and it's not a small thing, right? We can talk about it like, oh yeah, that's great, I'm going to be, but you're really on to it. Big deal. Yeah, thanks.
So I just wanted to see what came up for me when you were, I love the way that you started out the relative by talking about childhood and how childhood is this, you know, unending series of lessons in the relative. You know, oh, I grabbed my finger, that hurts. Oh, now mom's putting in the cold tap water, that feels better. Oh, now it hurts again. And yeah, so I totally was with that. And then I was also thinking about these traditions, Eastern and Western, that including the tradition I teach for a living, the Romantic tradition, that says, well, actually, you know, little kids start out in the absolute.
Oh, yeah.
Which I always thought, you know, I had turned myself into this hard-headed,
you know, I would mock this when I taught at my home until I had little kids. Mm-hmm. And then I would see them, you know, living in the absolute for hours on end. Mm-hmm. And I was like moved and touched and a little bit envious, like, oh, how do they do that? So I just wonder if there's a, you know, if there's a Buddhist angle on that.
Well, that was what I was trying to say, so I'm sorry that it wasn't more clear, but that we're born into the absolute, absolutely. and this childhood stuff, it's a training in learning a world of form, right? Because we couldn't survive in the absolute. And it's very interesting that human babies can't survive on their own. You know, it is just a continual training away, and a series of woundings also. You know, like you use the burnt finger thing that I don't. And so we learn to avoid the wound. And in Buddhist practice, we're taught to turn towards whatever's arising, which includes pain and suffering. That's the first noble truth of the Buddha, which was so wild. You know, that's why everybody went, wow, because really? Life really is suffering? Oh yeah, that's my experience. And it's an experience that if we were honest, there's no way, I think the world of form teaches us that we might be able to control things and you know, avoid evil, even in that, the three pure precepts. But we can't. The three pure precepts are actually undoable. Avoid evil, practice good, and save all beings. Okay. Sure. That's what you want. But we know that's not true, but there's a delusion that we could make that happen. And so I think you're right on about this. You know, and then in Western philosophy, we've got Freud, you know, who decided that opening and awakening experiences are regression to that wholeness, the undifferentiated awareness, right? But that's a turning of the screw, in a way, a reframe. And we could turn the reframe back, because it does go along with Buddhist teachings that Mahayana teachings, I should say, Great Vehicle teachings, because it's different in the Theravada, that everyone is already a Buddha, done, born that way, and then has to recollect. So I think it goes right along with Buddhist teachings. Your actual lived experience of being a father is a great teaching for recognizing innate wholeness.
And I think there was some progressive schools, Summerhill and some things like that, saying, well, the problem is that we adults are just ruining the children by teaching them right and wrong, and we should just let them go wild. And I think that's a privileging of the absolute over the relative, that it's actually quite important for our children that we train them into the relative world. And the relative world is not some inferior version of the absolute. That's a traditional spiritual position, that this is very much not that. That there really are things that we can do that cause less harm. And there really are things, and it's so important for each one of us in the world to do what we can. So impossible to avoid evil, but yet there are times when you can choose not to go down that road in your mind one more time. You know where it ends up, right? For you and for the people around you, for me and the people around me. So this choosing, this, and I love in these Lojong teachings, it's not saying, well, let's just deal with the absolute, let the relative take care of itself, but this basis of absolute, and from that we engage and enter the relative, not as, well, here's the lesser realm, we're kind of stuck here for a little while, but no, a box and its lid, right here.
So let's sit a little bit, and then we'll move on to the absolute relative forms of this retreat.